This is continuing with Wolfgang Priester on 30th August 76. But now, what did you think about the 2C and the 3C survey? Did you have...
We knew that there were quite a few objects in that survey which were just ghost pictures, of course, that everybody knew. And
did you go to the Paris Symposium?
In 58?
Yes,
I did.
Were you at this session?
I talked to Martin Reil on my paper, and actually, as a matter of fact, he even pointed out a little a mistake in my paper to me, and I'm very grateful that I could correct that. And the point is, the Paris Symposium and the Moscow IU meeting were just in time, they just followed.
Right.
And when Martin Reil and Peter Scheuer pointed that at that time my English was so bad, it's still bad enough, but it was so bad that Peter Scheuer had to talk in German to me. He speaks German fluently, and he's born in Frankfurt, so.
Right.
That I could make a correction, but I had sent that paper out already to the printer, and had in that night between the Paris Symposium, I went home to Bonn and went to Moscow. In that night, I had to work all night and just to make all the corrections. This was a minor mistake, but it didn't change the results. But it's just a bad thing to have a algebraic mistake in a paper. Then, if somebody finds it, he points out, "Oh, there is a mistake," so the whole paper
away.
And so I'm very glad that Sir Martin, which I admire, is the radio astronomer in the world, there's no doubt about that, pointed that out to me. And,
do you have any other memories of the Paris Symposium meeting? It seems to me that was a rather important
meeting. Yeah, there was a fight between Fred Hoyle and McVitie on using, but this is silly from the viewpoint, even from the viewpoint at that time, whether the Hubble constant is to be called a constant or not a constant.
I see.
But all this kind of little silliness.
I'd like to ask you about another meeting, namely in April 55 there was a conference on radio astronomy in Berlin.
Oh yes, I've been.
And I've seen the proceedings of this, but I don't know why this was organized and what the nature of. Could you tell me about that?
Otto Hachenberg organized that. He was then still in East Germany at the Adlershof. And as an academy symposium of the what was then still the Deutsche Akademie der Wissenschaften. I don't know how they call themselves now, they don't like the word Deutsch anymore, so whatever it is. I talked about the solar eclipse there, and Tachenberg talked about this interferometry on solar eclipses. And
Was it an important meeting at all for German radio astronomy, do you think?
It was basically on solar radio astronomy, I believe. I don't know whether I talked on the 200 megahertz survey, I don't recall.
No, you talked on the eclipse observations.
I talked on the eclipse, and that at that time. This was the only handle we had on the distribution. It's really funny, looking back at it, this is only 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And the only way in the meter range to find out what the distribution of brightness with distance is was to use the moon as a eclipsing object and things like that. And of course this was a very, very crude way to get results, and since you have to derive a two-dimensional brightness distribution from a one-dimensional set of observations, this cannot be solved without any additional assumption, and so what we could get at that time is sort of an ellipticity of the brightness distribution, which of course it was the only thing we had at that time, but it by no means would have been any final result to solve and to know it. And what we have now with the 100 meter dish, where we can scan the solar brightness at 3 centimeters and get automatically from the computer, get the whole brightness distribution.
Right.
You can see the coronal holes, which have been observed in the X-rays. You can see them in the centimeter range as well. There's no problem in that. But the funny thing is that the brightness, there is the limb brightening, which should occur, at 3 centimeters, it's not been seen at 3 centimeters.
With the modern observation.
With the modern observation. Yeah. This is, of course, it's a complete other step now, but sort of the same kind of problems arise, because at that time we really tried to find out how the brightness, or whether it goes up first at the lumen, goes down or something.
That was a controversial point then.
Not really controversial, but would like to have proved it or not.
Right. But was this conference important, in your opinion, for German radio astronomy in any sense?
The Berlin Symposium? Yeah. It was important for me, because at that symposium I got the offer to come to Bonn. I met Friedrich Becher there, and he asked me to come to Bonn. And so for me it was important, and I don't know whether it was important for Germany, I don't think so.
Well, I mean, were the radio astronomers talking to each other, the few that were in Germany at that time, or the people that were interested?
We didn't have much money to travel, so if we wouldn't meet each other, and by telephone it was out of the question anyway. Yeah. Nowadays we can't even phone anymore, because the budget is reduced for telephone.
But, okay, let me ask also, if you look at the first few years of the Stockert dish, the 25-meter dish, what do you think were the most important results that came from that dish?
There was this 11-centimeter survey, and
Altenhof et al.
Altenhof, and there were... you know that much better than I have forgotten those.
Well, I'm interested in your opinion, though.
There were some 21-centimeter line data, the paper by Grahl, on this, Gaussian analysis of the line profiles.
Right.
Which is really an important step. Nowadays, of course, the computer can handle that so easily. At that time, it had to be done really by deconvolving all these line profiles.
Right.
But to do it, and the special point they made is to use the neighborhood data to get the relation between the different Gaussian components. I guess that was an important step, because the Gaussian analysis was a generally known problem. But also to apply this to the neighboring points.
Right, right.
And in that respect, that paper was very important. But on the other hand, since we still published in German at that time, probably it wasn't really, became not much known to other people.
Now, did you work on radio astronomy in the early 60s also, yourself, or did you get most of
in this space? In the 60s,
early
I went
60s.
To the States, and I wrote a paper on which NASA then sold by, I believe, 5,000 copies or so, on extragalactic radio sources. It's NASA report, what is the number, 1444 or so.
A review paper?
It was actually my lecturing notes at the summer school on space physics. There was a summer school at Columbia University, a NASA summer school arranged by the NASA Institute
which
for Space Studies
that?
In 1964.
I see.
And these lecture notes, they have been widely sold and used, and many people still use them nowadays.
Do you have extra copy? I don't have a copy of that. That would be useful to have. Do you have any?
I have a new version of it, which we made now in 72 from another summer school.
Well, but I need the historical.
You need I can send you one.
Yeah, I would appreciate that if you could.
I still have a few left. NASA is completely sold out of it, because the demand was so high on that. But it was just useful. And let me see. I even have some new results in it. Unfortunately, I never put that in a special paper on that. Yeah. It concerns the evolutionary effects which had to be required on source counts to account for it. So this I made some upper or lower limit estimates what the evolutionary effect had to be, but by that time everybody agreed that there had to be evolutionary effects in it.
The space science you were doing was it astronomy or was it?
It was upper atmosphere physics.
Okay.
But it also, since, being there and teaching radio astronomy, and There were lots of excitement just in those years, particularly in July 64. There was, no, let me talk a little bit about things earlier, because in 63 we had the first Texas conference on relativistic astrophysics, 14 days after Kennedy was murdered in Dallas, and there was at that time.
What city was that in?
In Dallas, Texas.
Oh, it was in Dallas also, I see.
Dallas, Texas, the first Texas symposium.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no, this is something you have to know, because this has, there's one thing, of course, that at first was lots of discussion whether after, 14 days after that happened to Kennedy, we should have it there.
Right.
But on the other hand, people came in from all over the world, and when we arrived at Dallas, of course, the taxi driver didn't go straight to the hotel. He drove us around Elm Street first to show where it happened. And we were really shaken up. I was in the institute in New York when somebody was accidentally listening on the radio when it happened. So the whole workings collapsed at that time.
Yeah.
Really, everybody was listening and whatever. Just terrible experience.
Excuse me.
This Texas conference is, for, even for the history of radio astronomy, is one of an important step, and the book which came out of it, The Gravitational Collapse, has in the foreword about four or five pages of the history of radio astronomy, with all the situation, Bader Minkowski and the drinking a bottle of whiskey and whatever.
Right.
This is a very important thing, and I guess you should read that carefully.
Yes, indeed.
And at that Dallas meeting, we were first time jointly together with the relativists, and we all had our feelings. Look, relativity theory at that time was always considered a very high level thing, but nobody thought that there would be a chance for have it really applied, that there would be sometimes something which is called relativistic astrophysics. And even neutron stars at that time, I remember my good friend Hong-Hee Chu in New York, he worked on the theory of neutron stars, and I kept telling him, oh, Hong-Hee, what a lucky man you are, because nobody will ever be able to prove what you are doing.
Or disprove.
Or disprove. And but then, of course, God was so kind to provide the pulsars. And at the Dallas conference, one of the chairmen, I've forgotten who it was, came forward and said, now we talk always about quasar stellar radio sources. This is a very clumsy name, and we should find a new name for it. And so and everybody should send in a proposal at the end session, then we would vote on it.
I see.
And so at the end session, there were a few proposals made. One was, I remember, Radio Bonanza for it, which was rejected. I made the proposal Radio Galaxette, because I had in the back of my mind this is something which is a tiny little inside a galaxy, which now everybody, or not everybody, but secretly, everybody believes is the center of a collapse center of a galaxy. And Galaxette was not accepted either, and the whole thing, I've forgotten about the others, the whole thing remained open, and the astronomers dispersed without having agreed upon a name. And then Hong-Hee Chu had to write a paper for Physics Today on the subject of the Dallas conference. And when he had finished the draft of his papers, he came into my office and said, oh, Wolf, could you look it over, please, and check upon the correctness and so on. And we checked it carefully. Unfortunately, the printer later on mixed up the we and the new. There are quite a few bad things in the final paper, but it's just because they couldn't read the new and the we.
V
and the new,
right,
which looks so similar. So, but let's forget about that. But the important thing was this, that when he had written quasi-stellar radio source in one sentence, next sentence, quasi-stellar radio source, so he said, no, we have to find a short name for it. So we were thinking about that and came up with Questar. And then we said, okay, we can't use that because that's a brand name of this little telescope. And we, after a while, he decided really, and said, okay, let's use Questar, but leave the T out of it. And so he is the father of the word quasar, and I'm the godfather of it.
Okay, that's a good story.
So he finished that paper, and at that time, usually a copy of those papers from the Institute, they went to Walter Sullivan.
Yeah.
You know him.
He's no relative.
No.
I know him.
And went to him, and he wrote a story of the New York Times next day, or one of the next days on that, and with a big headline, Quasar. And since that time, almost all astronomers use this, except the people of, around Martin Schmidt and Jesse Greenstein. Probably they felt that they should have invented the word, or invented a word, and so they still use QSO and all this kind of business.
Right.
it's too bad, but just from West Coast to the East Coast.
Right. Were the redshifts recognized at the time of this conference? I can't quite remember.
Yes, that was the important thing. In 62, you know, the whole thing happened, there were two steps to it. By the way, that is in detail also in that NASA report I'm going to
Well,
to.
And I've talked to Martin Schmidt and so forth, so
course,
I've gotten some of the story,
this,
but I'm interested in this conference because I have not heard about
Let me start a little bit earlier if we have more minutes.
Yes, sure.
There was a conference at the NASA Institute for Space Studies in New York on those objects in sometime in 62, either in summer or fall. There is a book published by Cameron and Brancasio, or whatever the other name is, on that problem. But at that time...
was this the one called non-thermal radio sources?
Yeah, right, that is the one. And at that time it was not realized, because there were two important steps. That was Cyril Hazard, who made the lunar eclipse of 3C273 in 72, or in fall 72.
62.
62, I'm sorry, 62. And then, of course, there came the Martin Schmidt's paper in March 63. And so in that conference in November 72, the whole thing was in the open air, and there was this beautiful paper by two people from Caltech, Matthews and...
Sandage
and Matthews, where they had all the discussion on those strange objects and didn't know the real answer to it. The whole paper came out in APJ and was already... but it's still a very good paper for the history of science, a very important paper, I would say.
Certainly, but now the conference you're talking about now is the one in New York City, not the
Dallas. That is in New York City. So at that one... a year later, there was the Dallas conference, and in the meantime, the whole situation had changed. And
was that conference set up after the redshifts were discovered? Do you know? I mean, was that the impetus?
I don't know whether we regretted in New York that we hadn't waited for half a year. That's for sure. whether it was set up afterwards, must have been.
Who did set it up? You know.
Robinson and Schücking probably were the promoters of it. Mm-hmm. Eberhard Schücking and Robinson, those who published the book on it.
Maybe if you could tell me.
Edited the book.
First about the.
It must have been, because otherwise there would have been no good point for the relation with the relativists.
Right.
So it must have been, but I can't really prove it. Yeah.
Well, I can check.
But you
on
can
that.
Talk right. to Cameron, and you can talk to Schücking. He's in New York, so.
Yeah. Let me ask about the New York conference first. What were the ideas that people were thinking about these star-like objects? Were they thinking it was back to radio stars, that they were in our galaxy?
This is a story. When I have to give a popular talk on that, that is a story I say that Sandage made that statement, even especially in the Sky and Telescope report, back to radio stars, and then again, the whole thing was not a star at all. I don't know. This was for years. Look, there were redshifts of 3C48 and in the paper by Matthews and Sandage. There were redshifts, and nobody thought of that there could be a large redshift in it. Spectra measured with strange lines nobody could understand, and nobody thought that there would be really redshift that large because everybody thought of stellar objects. It would have been ridiculous. And in gravitational redshift was disproved by Martin Schmidt and Greenstein afterwards only. So perhaps nobody had thought of it. But it's hard to remember all those details. Yeah. Really.
And now,
now the Dallas conference, I told you. And there's another nice aspect to the connection with relativity theory. Came a year later in July 64 when the lunar eclipse of the Crab Nebula occurred.
Right.
And Herb Friedman with his group measured the X-ray radiation, and everybody of us in the Institute knew that would be coming forward, and in particular Chu as the promoter of neutron stars and Alistair Cameron. They all said, now we will see there is a neutron star which provides the X-rays, and so that means that if the lunar eclipse goes over it, out of a sudden the X-rays will disappear. And so they were on the phone a day or 2 days later after the measurements had been taken and called up Naval Research Lab.
Right.
And I still can see the bad mood when they came at lunch or whatever.
Right.
we met on this. And they said, oh, the X-rays went down like this,
yeah.
And this is about 1 light year large, this object which makes the continuous X-rays.
Right.
Of course, they couldn't. We all knew there had to be something strange, absolutely clear that there had to be an object somewhere inside, an invisible object. That's what we all thought, invisible, by any spectral range, which provided the relativistic electrons.
Right.
We all knew that the synchrotron radiation in the optical range, the lifetimes of those electrons is less than 1,000 years, so
right.
They have to be continuously replenished.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when they came forward with there is a light, 1 light year, then we sat down and just calculated, okay, if this invisible object the neutron star later on, and whatever it was. I don't know whether we knew it had to be a neutron. Of course, we knew it. Theoretically, it had to be a neutron star because of the theory of supernova collapse. But
I'm not clear about that. I mean,
I'm not so clear either.
I mean, did people really predict that neutron stars would be associated with supernovae?
Yes, I guess, yeah. This was the idea. It just had to be proven or not. That is the point.
Yeah. But now,
that was clear, yes. And
I
so this was a bad disappointment that the X-rays didn't come on there. But then immediately we sat down and said, okay, if that neutron star, or that object, let's leave it open, produces relativistic electrons which provide optical and X-ray emission, optical and radio emission, then why shouldn't we expect them to have their energy spectrum extended such that it also can provide X-ray emission? And then we can calculate immediately by knowing what the magnetic field in the nebula around that object, that unknown, invisible object is, what the lifetime of those relativistic electrons would be. And I sat down and calculated and came up, this is about 10 years.
Right.
So since random walk process circling around spiral field, they could not be gone further than about 1 light year. So it's very natural to expect the X-rays to be contained in 1 light year and to have the optical and radio contained in 5 light years radius. So this was a very natural explanation and even pointed out more to the point that there is a secret source of relativistic electrons.
Did you publish this?
No,
this
we didn't publish it because everybody made the same calculation.
Yeah.
That is, has nothing to do with priorities and things like that. And
but now, at the first Texas meeting, can you tell me what people were thinking about these high redshifts? Did everyone believe them, first of all?
Oh, yeah, sure. At the Dallas conference, the redshifts, I guess almost everybody said that there can only be cosmological redshift. I don't think, let me just remember whether there were doubts on that. Later on the ARP and even Jeff Burbidge's idea that they are related to close-by galaxies.
And his fellow Terence, what was his name?
The local theory,
right.
Yeah. the local theory.
Well, but I was even thinking that people might say, well, those are not the lines you say they are, and you've just got misidentified lines.
No, I don't think...
No one was saying that.
No, nobody was saying that. The identification in case of 3C273 was so good. Of course, there was one joke or one interesting point to it. It is the identification of 3C295, which is a radio galaxy,
right,
and had been identified by Rudolf Minkowski on the basis of one line only.
Right.
And this was proven later on to be correct.
Right.
Of course, there was lots of joke on that. But he explained how what additional evidence he had, and but still people said, this is shaky. And
and that was the highest redshift of
anything. It was the highest redshift of any galactic type object.
It was for 15 years.
As an extra galactic, a galaxy type object.
Right.
Galaxy type object. I have to be careful with my English, yeah. Galaxy type object.
Right. But so what were people doing? So most people were accepting that they were cosmological.
Most people were accepting, as it has always been.
But then you had this fantastic luminosity that was implied.
Yeah, this
implied,
is, of course, a strange thing, which is still the open problem.
Right.
Still the open problem. How to get it? And now he is Sterling Colgate. You have been in that session in the afternoon.
Yeah, I've been doing these.
He came up with...
who's he?
Sterling Colgate.
Yeah.
The two...
Right. Toothbrush man.
Toothpaste man. Yeah.
Right.
He is a clever guy actually, and
yeah,
he came forward with a new idea, but nobody understood it.
Yeah.
We had a big show here, in that afternoon, Sterling Colgate, and then Tommy Gold, and then Victor Ginsburg, expressing their views, and
let me ask now about beginning, just the very beginnings of the Bondish. When did people feel that something bigger than Stockert was needed?
Oh yes, we felt that pretty early already. The basic problem we had always was to get manpower of trained people trained in radio astronomy with electronic experience and so on. This, and to get positions enough to fill those posts. This was one of the basic problems we still have in Germany. Now look at the manpower of our astronomy department, including the Max Planck Institute. 30% don't speak German.
Right, right.
And so nowadays we just get them from outside. But in the early days it was impossible to hire an American.
Yeah.
He wouldn't come on the basis of a German salary.
Yeah.
And wouldn't have been attractive. The salaries aren't not comparable to the American ones, but the situation has changed, and the telescope now is really attractive.
Sure.
That makes all the difference. Now we started out on the first ideas even at the time already when we built the 21 meter dish. We have at near our optical telescope, we have a big large hole in the Eiffel Mountains, and so we thought of something. I don't know whether the Arecibo idea was already in the air. Probably.
Oh, yes.
It
was finished in 62 or 3 or something.
Yeah, but this was in 57.
Oh, I see, you're going way
this
back.
Going way back to 56 or 57, yes. And we thought of some fixed dish, large dish.
I see.
And in the first real plan, we got a promise for 35 million marks in 1961. Exactly at the time when the Berlin Wall was built,
right,
and Hachenberg was available. We had tried to get him. At that time, Hachenberg lived in West Berlin and worked in East Berlin, so he couldn't go to work anymore. So this was a good reason. And so at that moment, Friedrich Becker persuaded him to come to Bonn,
mm-hmm,
and so he got a professorship there. And with the idea already to build a large dish, sort of 80 meters at that time,
I
or
see,
something of that order, and we approached the government of North Rhine-Westphalia the man in charge was Professor Brandt, B-R-A-N-D, And he had given us lots, Leo Brandt, L-E-O, first name.
Right.
Leo Brandt was very important for the promotion of getting money for radio astronomy. And he had promised us this money out of his budget. But then there was an election and he was thrown out and the whole money was gone. And it took us till 1964, 65. And Friedrich Becker-Hachenberg and myself made a request to the VW Foundation, Volkswagen Werk Foundation. And in after some back and forth with the Tübingen project on the, by that time Sebastian von Hörner had an offer to go to Tübingen and he wanted to have a 150 meter dish but for meter wavelength range. So there were two proposals which came in. Ours was a little bit earlier, but it didn't matter really.
Yeah.
So there were two proposals and it had to be decided.
This is about what time now?
That was in, let me just think about by that time it was 64. Yeah, 64.
And what exactly was von Hörner's idea? I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, you can talk to him perhaps, if he still likes to talk about this problem, because it, the whole thing collapsed, the project collapsed. And but in Germany it was quite a problem because now two groups wanted to have von Hörner is in Greenberg still. He didn't go to. He didn't accept the offer of Tübingen because he didn't get the money for the telescope. And now I've forgotten what I was talking about.
Well, I just wanted to ask you, just basically what he wanted. It was a meter.
That was a telescope, a very light. A structured telescope, 150 meter in diameter, which would be able to observe lunar eclipses of radio sources. This was a basic aim. And
operate at meter wavelengths, you said?
Operated at down to 50 centimeters or something like that. And so he thought he would be able to build it for the same amount of money. And there was lots of going back and forth which project, because it was clear from the very beginning that only one project could be financed.
Right.
So,
did he have the homologous principle in this dish?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, this is another story on that. Because in 19, it's called after his naming it now, but the point is that the principle, without having a name for it, was applied before that to the construction of the 100 meter dish in Bonn. And what he did, we went to, in April 65, we went to Greenbank. By that time, we tried to get von Hörner over to Bonn. And we had this problem. Did we have that money already at that? No, we didn't. It was, the decision was still open then, and by that time there was already the clear idea that we also needed a big institute for it, and the land, federal state, North Rhine-Westphalia, probably would have been too big for it, so the approach came to the Max Planck Society. But in both cases, in von Hörner's case and in our case, both asked the Max Planck Society to provide the institute for it.
I see.
So then there was a problem now where to build it. And von Hörner said, I have also, in addition, this offer. He would then have become a Max Planck professor, in addition to his university position. Mm-hmm. And so he offered Hachenberg to come over to Tübingen, in addition to the Max Planck, and vice versa. We said, why don't you come to Bonn? And he said, I have this offer at Tübingen University, but I said, Max Planck professor in Bonn is equally as good. Yeah, he said, I can't leave Tübingen alone and just present aside. So the whole thing went back and forth, and finally, there was a special group invited by the Max Planck Society, which met in Munich in, which year was it? It was in December 65, or 64, I don't know. Which consisted of Denise from France, Bohr, quite a few internationally known radio astronomers. I forgot who it was really. And at that meeting, and also the companies which were supposed to build it, or at least they had been asked which one they could build, they had rejected this light structure offer, that project. And so that finally acted where the companies who really said, we are not going to build it.
And what was their objection?
They said it would vibrate in the storm and things like that. Yep. They couldn't guarantee the requirements. But von Herder was so positive that he had figured out all the mechanics.
Yeah.
But they said, oh, this is a bloody theoretician. You know, he's a very known high-level theoretician,
right.
But the engineers have their different point of views on that.
Right.
And it's really too bad that he didn't come to Bonn. So he then got into argument with the president of the Max Planck Society, and the whole thing collapsed, and he stayed in Greenland.
But I'm still confused as to whether this homologous principle. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, no, we went. We had thought about the construction, and knew that we could, by requiring the construction design. You know, this has to be put on a computer nowadays with all the strengths of the different metal. What is that?
The girders,
tubes,
yeah.
Tubes or whatever you have, and you can design it such that if you tilt it. It still remains a paraboloid with a slightly change in the direction and a slight change in the focal length.
Right.
So, and we talked about that, and he didn't say anything about that. He had done some analytical solution for the one-dimensional case. So I don't know whether he did it before or not. I can't really prove that. But he didn't go into any argument on that, so we explained that. He might have listened to it and had forgotten it, had done it earlier, or he might have done it earlier. Those things usually are in the air. We shouldn't place any priority on it. But from my point of view and Hachenberg's point of view and all those people who know those details in detail, it's absolutely clear that he doesn't have any priority on that because the company had already the requirements for it, and they had to put it on the computer. We didn't do it ourselves. What von Herder did is to find a solution for the one-dimensional, just one case for it. But for two-dimensional, you have to do it by trial and error.
I see. So what you're saying is that the company had already come up with this idea, or that you...
Not the company. No, we told the company
to do
it.
I see.
That is for sure.
And you were quite clear that it could be done.
That it could be done, yeah. That there should be an... look, this can be done only... in an approximative way. You cannot have a perfect solution in a mathematical sense.
Right.
And our approach was to put it on a computer and just to change all the parameters, that means the thickness and the size of the tubes, in such a fashion that the deformed parabola will be represented again by a good mathematical parabola with a slight focal length,
right.
And slight different axis,
right.
Which doesn't matter. The computer has to correct anyway for refraction and everything.
Right,
so
right.
That was the basic idea. And
in von Herder's proposal, he did not explicitly talk about doing this with his dish, as far as you remember. I can ask him.
I don't know whether he wanted to have it that way. He sure had to. But I don't know whether when he asked for the money, whether that was already in. I don't know, but...
And so then construction on the Bonn dish finally began when? What year?
Well, you better ask Hachemey on that.
This is getting a bit beyond my cutoff date. But
I see, yeah.
Must be 67.
67 or so, yeah. I forgot.
Well, okay, just to close, let me ask if looking over the development of radio astronomy, and, of course, in particular, German radio astronomy, do you have any comments you'd like to make on how you've seen the field?
Biggest problem is still the manpower problem we have. There's one basic problem. There are not enough geniuses around.
or is it something to do with the German educational system that does not produce the sort of people you want?
It could be that... astronomy as a field is perhaps not attractive enough. We had the same problem with space research in the beginning. My good friend Bob Jastrow in New York, he really went around and went on TV and whatever did to attract the cream of the people, not just the Maxwellian tail at the other end of the distribution. And
now, what time are you talking about?
This was in the early 60s.
Well, that was when
NASA was built.
Right,
yeah.
And the whole Sputnik scare. And
Yeah, but even then, there was, look, this strange thing happened. There was a phase shift. And we felt the same thing, a phase shift of attracting young people by about 3 or 4 years after the Sputnik shock. Not immediately afterwards, the students poured in, and the intelligent end, that is the important thing. The whole number of many, we don't care too much. You have to have a few very bright fellows who really promote things. It's always very few who do. And the same thing happened in the States, that still students who really thought about physics wanted to do elementary particle physics. Nuclear physics was already on the way down in that sense. But to go into space research, they didn't believe this had a big future or had a scientific appeal for really basic things, you know.
Well, maybe a student has to be hearing this for 3 or 4 years, you know, during his entire undergraduate years before he...
His inclinations towards certain subjects will develop. It's not a decision from one day to the next.
Right. So when you're a senior, you can't change your mind.
And nowadays, the situation is in worse. Now we produce too many, as a matter of fact, but still we would like to have among those very bright fellows. And some are. It's the situation nowadays, what I'm thinking of. We produce right now in Bonn, we produce about 30 PhDs in astronomy within the next 3 years, and about 30 diploma of physics in astronomy. And then we get 60 people who would like to become astronomers. And
but you're saying that even the best of those are not quite the sort of people that you want.
This is hard to measure, really. You know, you can never know in advance. And but you always would like to push that up. But this is
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And now we were talking about synchrotron radiation, and as you said, Kiepenhauer made the original suggestion in 1950.
50, yes, in physics reviews,
right.
Yes. And this was an absolutely perfect paper, and the estimates were absolutely correct, except that he used a rather low magnetic field and instead used too high a density of the relativistic electrons.
Right.
And for his estimate, he used, to say, the number density in the galactic spiral arms is equal to the number densities of relativistic electrons at each given energy is equal to the number density of the relativistic protons at the same energy. And because of this mistake, the other people who knew that the cosmic ray people had set up already an upper limit down to 1% of that number and not 1 to 1.
Right.
Because of that mistake, this paper did not get accepted for really 6 years. This is the point.
Yeah.
And then in Rashaslovsky and Ginzburg took it up. And by 1954, we had a beautiful German translation of this marvelous Ginzburg paper on synchrotron radiation.
Right.
And I pointed, and at that time, Unseld was sitting on the last chapter of Physics of Stellar Atmospheres, on the chapter on radio astronomy, and I pointed it out to him and said, this is a paper, please read it. Here is it translated in German. I had, this came out in the Academy in East Berlin.
Right.
And I had a copy of it. It was really printed and it was available, no problem. And he was probably too tired, so he handed it back to me after a couple of weeks and said, it doesn't work that way. And so I wasn't insisting enough, unfortunately. It's too bad. I should have pressed him, but he was a big boss and I was a young assistant. And I should have done it.
Synchrotron radiation is not mentioned at all then in that chapter?
It is mentioned in a footnote that it doesn't work.
I see. So it's also true that in the
And in 1956, then John Hendrik Ott looked into it from the optical point of view, the optical polarization, and at that moment when Ott accepted it, everybody else accepted it. This is the way sometimes theories work.
Yes,
you know,
right.
If a man like Ott had accepted it, then it became fashionable.
Right. No, now Ott, of course,
is the interview with Priester on 30th August 76.